Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We want you to know there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling, stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. That's Snap Judgment. Find it on iTunes under podcasts. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we've got dirty words on the brain. More specifically, we're talking about the use and functions of profanity in entertainment and on how it may or may not be changing. Speaking of change, we'll tackle the theme of obsolescence. How do outdated technologies or other social and cultural upheavals force stories to readjust or make themselves senseless entirely? And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and theater and that sort of thing.
And Glenn Weldon back from his journey out of town. What do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website. And yeah, you had a good episode last week talking about Twitter.
We did.
I think you were missing a voice. You were missing a perspective.
Somebody. Where's Glenn?
Somebody who doesn't have a blue Twitter verified check next to their name.
That's why we couldn't let you be here.
That's right. You were unverified, so we couldn't.
That was a discussion for verified.
All of you people in your blue ivory verified tower just talking about Twitter and its uses. We needed the voice of the people. We needed a little bit of me, but still it was a good show.
Yeah, it was a good show. We appreciated Audie being here, but we're awfully happy to see you, buddy. And so you just so Stephen, why don't you talk a little bit about your observation that got us onto the topic of swearing.
Okay. I mentioned last week that I recently became, turns out, one of the last people to see Anchorman. And I was very struck by something very clever they did, where they spent about, I don't know, the first 45 minutes of the movie never swearing. It sets itself up to be this very naughty movie, but it feels like it's sanitized for television. And there's even a scene where the Christina Applegate character is yelling in anger, and she's saying, "That is baloney! That is baloney!" And you know they are doing this very deliberately. And the reason they're doing it deliberately is to set up a big climactic moment about halfway through the movie where Ron Burgundy, the titular anchorman, is sitting there and...
Titular, not a dirty word.
Uh-huh. And so basically as a prank on Ron Burgundy, it has been established that he will read anything on the teleprompter. And so they have written on the teleprompter, and which he dutifully says at the end of his broadcast, instead of his signature send-off, he says, "Go yourself, San Diego." And this becomes, of course, this sends him spiraling down and sets up one of the big central conflicts of the movie that needs to be resolved.
And we should say, before we go any farther, we will be bleeping any profanity that we actually utilize, but if you do not like the bleeps or you do not even like a discussion of profanity, perhaps around your co-listeners, perhaps listen to this one on your own.
I'm only speaking for myself, but I'm just incredibly Twitter-pated at the concept of being able to curse like a sailor into an NPR
microphone.
Yeah,
that's true. I did this recently for a very interesting piece that Netta Ulaby did about swearing, and she taped an interview with me, and I swore into the NPR microphone so much that Netta and I decided later they were going to have to, like, sanitize it, and they were going to have to dip it in something.
Dip it in hydrogen peroxide.
Because I had violated the microphone. I had sworn so much. Because we were talking about different swear words and, like, what the absolute worst ones were. Mm-hmm. So, like, it was very filthy.
Well, I enjoyed the fact I was tweeting about how much I curse while driving and how much I curse in the office or whatever. And somebody wrote in on Twitter and just said, "I just cannot picture Steven swearing."
Oh, boy.
And somewhere my kids are like, watch football with the guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, what they're doing in Anchorman is a classic withholding technique, right? They're going to build your appetite for something. The classic example of it that I like to refer to, because Bob Mondello pointed it out to me, was in the original production of Chicago in 1975. They never let you see Gwen Verdon and Che Guevara on the stage at the same time. Well, they're on the stage at the same time, but they never dance together. They never have a number together until the very final one. And they come out and they do this very basic, simple routine. But the fact that they're on stage together, moving together, finally, at the end of the show, apparently just drove the audience berserk.
And what the f*** does this have to do with swearing?
You know me. I like a f*** digression.
Well, okay, so this sort of ties in. It doesn't at all. But let's pretend it does. George Carlin's classic comedy bit, The Seven Words, mm-hmm. They'll Never Say on Television, he did it many times over the years, and he kept changing the list. I mean, one of his follow-ups was how the list keeps changing and certain words kind of fall off and on. But the seven core that he started out with, of those seven, all seven have been on cable.
Right. By now. I'm sure, yeah.
Four out of the seven have been on broadcast network by now.
Wow.
And that's striking to me. There's two or three that will never be on any broadcast television network. But it was striking to me that there was so many that had actually just sort of fallen out.
Yeah.
The NYPD Blue.
That's sort of what Netta's piece was about.
Yeah.
Netta's piece was about, specifically about the difference between, as we would call them, the F word and the S word.
Mm-hmm.
And how even a cable network like AMC, you can basically have as many S words as you want, but according to the story, but they count the F words. And then they start bleeping them after a very small number. Not bleeping them, dropout. They have audio dropout.
I think that somewhat the same is true of South Park, that depending on the time of day that Comedy Central is showing South Park, they will, and I know at one point they were able to show the South Park movie.
Right.
Actually uncut.
It's not. Wow. It's
which
not,
that movie is filthy.
And it's not the FCC. I mean, on cable, it's not the FCC. And after 10 o'clock at night, it's not the FCC.
Right.
You just don't. It's the same reason that even though we are not on the radio, we are a podcast, we're not going to unload it on you.
It's because we're not at
it was South Park that had the episode about where they just say the word over and over again.
I think it's 169 times.
Don't they keep a running tally on the screen?
You ready? Tonight, on Cop Drama, on TV, they're going to say... They're going to say... On television? You can't say on television. It was just on the news. People are freaking out, dude. Holy
We gotta work.
Yeah, I'm gonna have people over to my house to see it.
But I got these tickets to see Lion King on stage.
Maybe you didn't hear me, Kyle. I said on television. It's just a marketing play by the network. Like that time they had the first male-to-male kiss with Terrence and Phillip. Oh, come on, dude. This is history. It's stupid.
And that kind of establishes very clearly that it gets deadening. It loses its power after, like, maybe 30.
Do you remember what the episode title was?
I don't.
It's called It Hits the Fan.
There we go.
Yeah. Nice. Well, and I think the big debate about profanity is always whether or not it's in some way necessary or useful, or does it have an impact, or is it mostly lazy? And I've definitely seen movies where, particularly if it's very nasty and directed at other people all the time and said in anger and kind of like a...
It can be deadening, absolutely.
It's very deadening, and it does get boring, and I do get kind of tired of listening to it.
Right.
But there are also movies where the one that came to mind for me was Die Hard, which has several really, to me, indispensable uses of profanity. There is a moment where John McClane is trying to call for help to the emergency number, and he calls on the emergency channel because, of course, he's a police officer and he knows which one is the emergency channel, and he calls, and the operator, who does not know he's a police officer, is hearing this apparently senseless claim that there are terrorists taking over this office building, and she thinks it's a prank, and so she says, sir, this is for emergency calls only, and he says, no, lady, do I sound like I'm ordering a pizza? And I consider it one of the absolute greatest uses of profanity in the history of film, because
it's a realistic use of...
Well, it's also totally necessary. There's no other way to say that line that would feel as good as that one does. And it's the same a couple minutes later. She says, you know, if you don't get off this line, I'm going to report you to the such and such. And he says, fine, report me. Come the down here and arrest me. And it's one of my favorite lines in the movie. And it doesn't work if he says, come the heck down here. And like, it's not as funny. It's funnier and it's more believable and it's more intense with that language in it. So there, I believe it.
Which does make me want to ask our producer, Lauren McGaughey, to play me a little clip that I brought in. I've talked on the show before about how much I love Mr. Show. And they have a sketch comedy show on HBO, and they have a priceless sketch where they're parodying Goodfellas, but it's edited for television. And so it's called Pally's.
Yep. Loopy nerd.
We buried. He's probably stinking up the whole
parking
forest by now.
Hey, watch your
mother, father,
mouth. Don't you tell me what to do, you little piece of shoe.
That's my aunt,
you mother father.
And after the second mother father, he holds out his fist, and they just crudely cut out where his middle finger would be and replace it with a thumbs up.
Yeah.
Well, that has produced, that whole dubbing for television has produced some classics. Like, for example, Yippee-Ki-Yay, Mr. Falcon.
Mm-hmm.
Die Hard. I'm tired of these monkey fighting snakes on this Monday to Friday plane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And perhaps my favorite, from The Exorcist, Your Mother Knit Socks That Smell.
Yeah, well, and I think there were a couple that were just classics that for a while everybody kept seeing on television. And there is a heavily edited version of The Breakfast Club that floated around for a long time where they kept saying, flip you.
Right.
No, Dad, flip you. And it's like, for some reason, the combination, and they captured in that Mr. Show thing, the combination of the fake language and the obvious dubbing always really makes me laugh.
Of course, in the right hands and with the right mouth, cussing can be musical and really propel.
Yes.
These cuss words are Anglo-Saxon. They're short. They're guttural. They end in a hard sound. They are like the pistons that drive language. They're the percussion instruments of language.
Right, yes.
So this is why when you hear nothing but drumming, but somebody like the character of Malcolm Tucker on The Thick of It, played by Peter Capaldi, uses. I was going to bring in a clip. It would just be one. There's no purpose.
It would be like Lil Wayne at the Grammys.
Exactly.
Right. My note was in the loop, but yes.
But also Glengarry Glen Ross, all those Mamet monologues with. I was thinking of the Al Pacino version with playing Ricky Momma. It's again, it's just nothing but long strings of this incredibly Byzantine language, punctuated by these little pops that wake you up.
Yeah, and I think it's because I value it having those pops, and I value it having some heft so that it's still funny and so that it still startles, that I don't like thinking of it as something that's like, you know, somehow that word is bad or this word is good or bad. But it's hard to make the case for it. But what I really like is I do like to see some of those words limited.
Right.
Not only because they are awfully coarse when they come out of the mouth of like an 11-year-old.
Right.
But because that way, if you keep them and you don't use them too much, then they make me laugh more when they come up, as opposed to, you know, if I have been listening to something where that kind of stuff is just used constantly, then if somebody says, you know, the same line and it's full of swearing, then it doesn't hit me the same way.
Well, if in Anchorman there had been a bunch of F-bombs dropped, him saying go yourself San Diego would be so much less impactful. Woody Allen in The Front culminates in this big dramatic scene in which a gigantic F-bomb is dropped. And it is very jarring. It is crucial to the movie. Uh-huh. And it would not be nearly as effective if that movie just were full of profanity all the way through.
When you're creating alternate realities, sometimes some creators like to insert fake cursing. Mm. Battlestar Galactica, the original series back in the 70s, used the term, that's a bunch of Felger carb, which is like, it works. It's too hard to work. The people who made it recently in the last decade had a different option.
What's up?
Nothing, sir. Just another leak in that fracking window.
Frack me. Oh, frack! Frack! Brief frack and abort. Oh, frack me.
Now he's got to get that fracking gimbal locked or I'll have his ass.
Etc., etc., etc.
I would certainly hope that somebody compiled a loop and that's not all one scene.
That is not all one scene. That is all the fracks from Battlestar Galactica.
See, and I do find that more distracting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's exactly my point.
If they would just have said the whole time. Like, I don't know.
I can buy that in space we all write on octagons. I can buy it. Sure, fine. Doesn't make any sense, but let's do it. But that always kicked me out. And the people who, in the real world, use that expression, even though there are perfectly acceptable other curse words, that bugs me. That mystifies me.
You mean like...
Well, yes, exactly. For example, use that.
Yeah, I feel like that's better.
Firefly, another science fiction show, had a much more, I think, interesting take on it. What they would do, it posits that in the future, Western and Eastern culture will have melded together so that it filled the show up with a lot of curses in Mandarin. Not actual curses in Mandarin, because what the writers would do would come up with some kind of silly curse, then turn to somebody and ask them to translate into Mandarin, literally, so it often didn't make sense, and then teach the actors phonetically how to say it. So, for example, Holy Mother of God and all her wacky nephews, that's one. The explosive diarrhea of an elephant, and my favorite, Holy Testicle Tuesday. All of these are Mandarin curses on the show Firefly.
Nice.
Wow. I do want to talk about one cursing-related pop culture pet peeve, which is I'm specifically hearkening back to an old issue of Details magazine, where on the cover they have put a then ascending pop star named Pink.
Yeah.
And she is kind of pushing out her fist. You know, she's got a big Billy Idol sneer on her face, and she's pushing out her fist toward the reader. And on her fist is the jewelry, and it spells, "Kiss my A-star star." And is there anything less edgy on all of the entire planet of Earth than "Kiss my A-star star"?
Yeah.
It kind of loses its conviction midway through.
Also, when you see, like, totally uncensored, beep, 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 that's not uncensored.
Yeah,
right.
Indeed.
Right.
Oh, man. I came across a really wonderful essay by Ann Powers, NPR's own Ann Powers, from December 2011. It's called "The Year in Pop and Profanity." It talks about how these things go in cycles with each generation giggling and discovering this thing that their parents probably didn't have access to, but of course they did. She talks about blues singers back in the day, especially the lady blues singers who would just sing these filthy songs.
Mm-hmm.
And it name checks everyone from Rihanna to Angela Davis. It's a fine piece of reading, and
yeah,
I recommend it highly.
Piece.
And there's this piece from 1946 that still holds up, that still has power.
I have a sad story to tell you. It may hurt your feelings a bit. Last night when I walked into my bathroom, I stepped in a big pile of shaving cream.
There we go. See what we did there? A little misdirection.
Yeah.
That is Benny Bell, a little assisted, we think, by Paul Wynn, 1946. That was a staple of the Dr. Demento show, of course. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yep.
He's performed it a lot with Weird Al Yankovic lately. And in 1975, because of the Dr. Demento show, they re-released it, that same cut, and it got to number 30 on the Billboard charts.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a certain power when you're 6 years old, and apparently it's retained
some
of that power.
One of those, boys didn't do this. One of those things girls did with clapping and, like, the down, down baby, down by the roller coaster kind of stuff. There was one that was all centered around lines that ended with, Miss Lucy had a steamboat, the steamboat had a bell.
Miss Lucy went to heaven. The
steamboat went to hello, operator.
Yeah.
And so it's basically the same idea that you're swearing but not.
It's all about trying to get away with something.
Mm-hmm. Well, look at the Arrested Development bit where Tobias and Lindsay are fighting and he yells, "You selfish country music loving lady."
Right. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and the funny thing is that I used to work, when I was recapping television, prior to when I came to NPR, I worked incredibly blue a lot of the time. I mean, I knew somebody once who told me that he was very disappointed in the writing I was doing because I was swearing so much, and it's the mark of a lazy mind and all that stuff. And I remember kind of thinking, I don't necessarily believe that. It's the mark of a lazy mind if you can't not do it.
Right.
Which I guess is the reason why I've been happy to also have a job where mm-hmm. I don't do it, and I feel like I now could do either, you know? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, if you freed me up, I'd go back to swearing all the time.
As would Shakespeare, who liked a nasty double entendre as much as the next guy.
But there's a difference between double entendre and
using
simple profanity.
Sure. Right. But, I mean, a lot of...
Both have their place.
Yes.
Right.
And a lot of what he was doing was sort of pioneering simple profanities. I mean, there are terms that would have been unspeakably vulgar in his day that he uses in the plays. You know, that joke about country matters.
Yeah.
You know.
Trigram, read that right there. Would you mind?
Oh.
Read that right there.
Blah, blah, Shakespeare, blah, blah, country matters, blah. Trigram.
Yep. Called it. Called
in Glenn's notebook.
Called it.
In Glenn's notebook, that's what
nice.
It said. Blah,
nice.
Blah, trigram.
It's just a matter of time.
Yep.
You know, Glenn, I think, does that every week, and he's never really gotten to uncork one before.
I was going to say, Trey doesn't usually know about the pool.
Yeah.
Oh, do you have 29 minutes and 45 seconds?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. All right. Well, having seen Trey laid low, as it were.
Uh-huh. With affection. There's a big heart around it.
The heart is silent. That, by the way, is my album. Coming out soon. You should come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHHR
on
the
blog. And curse us out.
And curse us out, but don't do that, because we're still a clean operation around
still
here.
Still a family show.
We're still a family show. Or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And tell us kind of how you feel about this whole thing. And, you know, but no swearing, because, hey, you know, you don't have a bleep button.
Yeah, that's right.
You don't have a bleep button like we do. All right. So the other thing we were going to talk about today is actually came from our producer, Lauren McGaughey, who had this idea. We got to talking about movies where the invention of the cell phone, the invention of the internet, all these things have massively disrupted many movie plots that could previously have existed.
They've changed storytelling.
Now, Glenn, do you have like a blah, blah, Trey Graham, blah, blah, call Hamlet or something like that?
No, no.
Call Romeo and Juliet, something like that?
No.
Joke's been made.
All right.
Not just cell phones, but replacing landlines and rotary dials mm-hmm. when you see that sort of thing. But any number of out-of-date technologies. I mean, movies that are built around video rental stores,
right, sure.
for
right.
example.
The Ring.
I was going to make a sad joke about record stores and how you couldn't do high fidelity
anymore. Oh, yeah, exactly. Well, fortunately, there are still record stores. But one thing that I was thinking about with this is, does it matter? Like, obviously, in terms of storytelling today, going forward, you can't necessarily have, like, oh, all the lines in the house have been cut, so there's no way to reach the outside world. You have to find ways around that. Mm-hmm. Oh, my cell phone battery is dead or whatever.
Sure.
You have to at least explain it away. But, I mean, when you go back through movie history, there's tons and tons of stuff that you see in old movies that you understand, okay, there used to be telephone operators who would, you know, patch you through right. by moving one cord from one slot to another. You're not necessarily completely lost when you see that.
Right. And, you know, you wouldn't want to lose. I mean, you'd lose one of the great comedy scenes of all time, which is in Auntie Mame, where she's trying to work the switchboard.
Mr. Whittacombe, I have your San Francisco call for you. Yes, Mr. Bibman? Oh. Did I connect you with Mr. Gutterman instead of Mr. Applewhite? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Bibbicombe. Bib. Oh, Mr. Applewhite, what are you doing in that hole with Mr. Gutterman? Yes, Mr. Whittacombe? Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I'll try to reconnect you again with San Francisco. Oh, let me see. Mr. Bibbibib is in there talking to Mr. Bubba White. Where on earth is Mr. Applewhite? Oh, there you are, Mr. Applewhite. Mr. Whittacombe, there's no such place in San Francisco.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, sure.
That would be sad.
Yeah, it would be sad.
But you just replace it because, you know, we will always in movies have that scene, keep him on the line, we're tracing the call.
Yeah.
It's just that it used to take 3 minutes and now it takes 3 seconds. But see, now they've introduced this new magical thing called encryption, which keeps that scene just as long as it ever was.
Oh, typing fast.
It's like typing fast and saying, oh, he's rerouted it through redundant servers across the globe, which gives us another 30 seconds.
Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting, though, is that technology has always been a really difficult thing to get right in a movie, other than kind of as a side point. Because one of the reasons I personally think that the recent WikiLeaks movie with Benedict Cumberbatch, which was called The Fifth State, was not terribly successful, by which I mean very unsuccessful, is that when you watch that movie, they were trying so hard to make action sequences about guys sitting at computers that they came up with these kind of semi-abstract scenes of, like, people sitting in rooms. And it was obviously, you know, it wasn't to be taken literally. Like, all of a sudden somebody would get up and there'd be slow-mo of them smashing a room of 100 computers. And it was really supposed to stand for the destruction of servers. And, you know, you're trying to find much of the things that are most interesting about technology kind of defy visual representation, and that makes them very tough in movies.
Well, and a lot of your early computer-themed major films, your The Net, movies like that, where the sound of a modem dialing up is supposed to be suspenseful, and it's not. It really isn't.
Yeah. So a lot of the films that can't be made now because just the thing that drives the movie just doesn't happen anymore. Like in North by Northwest, Cary Grant flags down the wrong bellhop and causes somebody to mistake him for another person. That's a lot of Hitchcock films, which are based on mistaken identity. That suspense would have to, we'd figure out a way to do it, but that suspense would have to come from a lot of different places because in the age of Facebook, mistaken identity is tough. Now, stolen identity is now. Stolen identity is a different thing.
Right.
But the idea of a lot of these Hitchcock films, we need to do some work.
Right. One that I've talked about, and this isn't technology, but technology is not the only thing that can make the plot of a movie feel obsolete. There are a bunch of Hitchcock movies, Strangers on a Train is like this, Dial M for Murder is like this, that really rely around how hard it is to get a divorce if the other person won't give you one.
If no-fault divorce
no fault,
eliminates the need for a lot of these
movies. You lose the whole middle half or the whole latter half of the women.
Yeah.
Right? Right. And there's a whole, like, these stories that came from, I've met someone else, I want out of my marriage, the person won't give me a divorce, quote unquote, therefore I have to kill them, is something right. that used to happen not uncommonly in suspense movies. And mm-hmm. now you pretty much have to do that in terms of, I can't divorce them because they'll take all my money.
Right.
As for the technology, the thing I find most interesting, you know, Stephen was mentioning rotary dials and things like that. It's not stuff like rotary dials that, to me, is distracting from a technology perspective. I can look at somebody dialing a rotary phone, and it doesn't distract me at all. But the gigantic cell phones, like yeah, in Wall Street.
Right. Yes.
I watched Wall Street a couple years ago.
It looks like you're holding an iron to your head.
I watched Wall Street a couple of years ago. Now, that's distracting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the more it was supposed to represent at the time, some kind of cutting-edge technology right. that was only cutting-edge for this brief moment. Like, rotary dial phones were around and still are around in certain settings mm-hmm. for, you know, decades and decades.
But there's
and
no reason to have transitional technologies mm-hmm. lying around.
But right, but that brick phone from Wall Street, and there's a reason why that's, like, one of the totems of Saved by the Bell,
yeah.
is that it was only around for this brief, like, 3-year period that you would see movies and TV mm-hmm. shows that had these giant cell phones. And then they went to the cell phones that were slightly smaller but still had the super long antenna.
Yep.
It's not
They're
so much the obsolescence, but mm-hmm. you do have a certain amount of carbon dating of movies based on what cell phones people are using in them, particularly once you get to ones where they're like, oh, look, looking at the little screen where people are sending text messages right. back and forth. Right. And it's like,
aww. I was racking my brains to think of a movie or a TV show where the Apple Newton has been integral.
Yeah.
For that minute.
Well, you bring up a good side point, which is incredibly hilariously out-of-date product placement.
Yeah. Yes.
I have a feeling that in a few years, when you watch the fighting robot movie Real yeah. Steel, mm-hmm. the fact that the robots in the future fight in Bing Arena.
Everything's on yeah. Bing.
Even You've Got Mail.
Yeah.
The whole movie's built around the AOL slogan.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a movie called The Sixth Day with Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is set in, I believe, 2015, 2016. And in the future, everybody's watching the XFL.
Yeah.
But you talk about carbon dating a movie.
Yeah, you know, when you are setting a film in the future or a television show or whatever, I think the best way around it is to make the technology as magical as possible. Just mm-hmm. wave it away. Because,
right.
like, there's a thing about cyberpunk, which is supposed to look janky and shoved together. There's a thing about steampunk, same thing. So they have an internal consistency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a show that I love called The Prisoner from the 60s. Most of the sets had this incredibly sleek, overly stylized, wonderfully looking sort of magical technology, but then every so often you'd see behind the scenes and there'd be the scientists in white coat poring over punch cards very gravely with yeah. sinister intent. And it's like, oh, you just lost it.
Yeah. See also the floppy disk.
Right, the yeah. floppy disk.
At various points.
Well, I think it's one of those things where, as Stephen was saying earlier, it's not that you can't have some of these stories. Mm-hmm. Like, the many stories that would be rendered seemingly obsolete by cell phones, you can still have them. It's just that, and this is sort of the unfortunate part to me, it requires a sort of boring scene in which you establish
which you
the person has no reception. And there are a couple of supercuts of scenes from movies where people mm-hmm. point out that they have no cell phone reception because they're just about to suggest that the person has no way to call for help or the person is alone. You know, frankly, that comes up in Snow Bride from Hallmark, where she's, you know, she's off in the snow turning into a bride. And there's a little scene of her running around holding her phone up to the sky mm-hmm. trying to get reception because otherwise the scene doesn't make any sense. Yeah. You almost want to just have them be able to just like run a crawl along the bottom that's like no cell phone reception. Because so you don't have to keep watching these scenes where people are running right. around holding their phone. It happens in 27 Dresses. Katherine Heigl and Marston are holding their phones out of the window of the car. Do you have any reception? No, I don't have any reception. Oh, yeah.
Boy, it just occurred to me, you know that movie The Internship, where Vince Vaughn is an intern at Google? That is going to look so outdated in a Bing-dominated future.
Well, there are two big challenges, one of which is the ways the technology encouraged people not to leave the house. Mm-hmm. So you don't meet people at bookstores and like in When Harry Met Sally, when they bump into each other at the bookstore, or when people bump into each other at the grocery store. Like if we eventually live in a future where no one leaves their house, there will be meeting cute will be much more difficult.
You mean Glenn's idealized future?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
the future in which the only way you meet cute is the postman bringing you your Amazon Prime order.
Right, exactly. And eventually that's all going to be done by robots. So how is anyone going to be, you know, that's why you're starting to get like online dating movies and stuff like that, and movies where people meet on the internet, because, you know, otherwise where are you going to meet anyone?
Yeah, right.
So that's A, is not leaving the house. The other is unpredictability. You know, many narratives and narrative structures rely on some measure of unpredictability. And that's where you get into stuff like what Glenn was talking about with mistaken identity and things like that. You know, if you're trying to have something where somebody isn't who you think they are, the odds are you would have Googled the person and found that out. That if you talk about something like You've Got Mail, she would have Googled him. She would know what that guy looks like. She would have recognized him, not to be a jerk, but that's what would have happened. It's not very realistic. And if she ever did anything with AOL other than wait for the little Bing to say You've Got Mail. So I'm just saying, you know, the unpredictability that's required for a lot of narratives is hard to
generate.
Not just mistaken identity, but just in life.
Right.
Like, part of what people are using smartphones and internet for is like, I don't want to get lost. I don't want to waste time.
Right.
This is the whole thing of Google Glass. It's like, let's remove all traces of serendipity from our lives. That's going to make, you know, serendipity much more difficult.
The movie Serendipity?
Yeah. You know, I think it was the philosopher Jane Jetson. there's a clip from an old episode of The Jetsons where Jane has to talk to her friend first thing in the morning on those video phones that they predicted, and she puts on a mask of her own face because she's not quite ready.
Calling the Jetsons, Jetsons.
Morning, George, dear.
Ah, morning, Gloria. Honey, it's your friend Gloria, the cute-looking one.
Gloria? Oh, dear. I can't let her see me looking like this. I've got to put on my morning mask. I'll be right there, George. Hi, Glor.
Jane, darling, don't you look lovely? How do you do it?
I'm telling you, I give it 2 years. 2 years before we arrive at that, because Skype is a thing.
Yeah, and you're going to have a little mask of your own face.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, some technology stories never change, because just this week Fox debuted Almost Human, which is about a guy and his android cop partner. This happens to be a heavy, serious cop drama. It was also the theme of Holmes and Yo-Yo.
Yep, yep.
And it was also the theme of Mac and Cheese on Friends. So this has been done before. But the cop and the robot partner are eternal, you know?
Yeah.
No matter how technology may change, there are certain things we go back to over and over. Although, I pointed out this morning on Twitter, unrealistic plot in the extreme, because the robot cop is Michael Ealy and the person who runs that police department is a woman, and there is no way that a woman who runs a police department would have a perfectly good robot Michael Ealy sitting in a locker not using him for anything. I'm just saying. Because he's an android. He's like very human-like.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If I had Michael Ealy in a locker and he was very human-like, I'm just saying.
All bets are off.
So,
he wouldn't be sitting in there gathering dust.
So those two conditions have to be met, though.
I'm just saying, who would have a perfectly good dude sitting in there just needs you to put a stick in his ear and he wakes up and becomes a guy?
I thought that was going someplace different.
You put a stick in his ear and he turns into a real guy. That's what happened on the show. Don't blame me. Talk to J.J. Abrams.
Hey, guys, we should just hang back and let Linda keep talking.
Steven's like, tell me more about your sex robot.
Exactly. The stick goes where?
Anyway, so come and find us on social media, which now exists because it is the technology of the future, or send us a pigeon, because that's the technology.
A man on a horse. Mm-hmm.
And tell us what you think about all this. And that brings us to our final segment, what is making us happy this week. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week other than getting to say on our show?
That's true. That is another thing making me happy. I've got two things. Very, very different things. One is that I discovered by following a YouTube rabbit hole that there was an Amazing Race Canada There is a Canadian version of The Amazing Race.
Haven't we talked about this?
No,
Australia.
We've talked about Australia. But now there's Canada. It's 9 teams, and they just go from one end of Canada to the other, which is not ambitious. but all but one of the episodes at the moment is currently streaming on YouTube. Wow. I hope it stays that way. Mm-hmm. But I look forward to, at some incredibly sad moment when my kids are gone, sitting in my underpants watching TV in front of the fireplace and catching up on The Amazing Race Canada. The other thing is much more serious than The Amazing Race Canada, which is I finally saw 12 Years a Slave. Uh-huh. And it is freaking fantastic. I pretty much agreed with everything y'all said on the show when you had Gene and Kat in talking about it, including the fact that I would have cast somebody else in the Brad Pitt role. Uh-huh. But I was reminded of what I have said in the past about Schindler's List, which is it's this incredibly, incredibly serious movie, and everybody talks about it as if it's homework, and everybody sort of says, like, oh, man, it's incredibly tough to watch. It is incredibly tough to watch, but it is incredibly artfully made in a way that is entertaining.
Yeah.
It's a 2-hour-and-15-minute movie that, to me, felt like 90 minutes, and that is the hallmark of just an incredibly skillfully made movie. I loved it. I'm sure we'll be talking about it again when we do the Oscars, but that is certainly making me happy. I mean, happy is a relative term, but it is a wonderful film.
Uh-huh. Great.
Agreed.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week other than Glenn accurately knowing what you're going to say about
it? I know, right? Over this weekend, I was sitting with a friend. We were hanging out, and he put on, I am a Star Trek nerd. Mm-hmm. With the best of them. I can't quote chapter and verse.
I was going to say probably not never, with the best of them.
But I never got into Deep Space Nine. So he made me watch one of the later episodes. And the one he picked was Trials and Tribulations, which is the one where they go back in time and correct the plot, the Klingon plot to kill Captain Kirk with the exploding tribble. This is a thing.
This is, as you say,
and
a thing.
This is a thing. And the whole episode is about in-jokes about how dated the specific lighting schemes of the original series versus and what that looks like to people from 300 or 400, however many years it is later in Deep Space Nine. And it's just it gets funnier and funnier as it goes on. And I adored it. So it's good to know that there's something new for me to binge watch without having to, you know, and explore entirely new horizons.
Right,
the show does get better. The show, forget the first season.
What I keep hearing is that Gene Roddenberry, the creator, was adamant about not letting them have a war.
Right.
So after he died, the people who inherited the mantle sort of changed the rules of the universe.
And, it complicates and itself picks in interesting things up. Ways. It's very nice.
But the other thing I had was some friends of mine drew my attention to this yesterday. This guy in Chicago, a few years back, essentially discovered one of the most talented street photographers ever. No one knew anything about her. She was a hoarder. She was a recluse. Kind of eccentric, but she had an astonishing eye, and she left behind hundreds of thousands of negatives, 700 rolls of unexposed film. So the story's been getting out for a few years, and there have been big gallery exhibitions, but now there's a documentary. It played in Toronto this year, but it's only just now getting out in the States, and my friends Stephen and Patrick, saw it last night at Doc NYC, and they immediately made me swear to pass the word about it here. So it is called Finding Vivian Mayer. And it is about the essential mystery and unknowability of this woman, about whom they've been able to find out a lot, but not everything.
Wonderful. Always good to know about a new documentary.
Indeed.
Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Well, obviously, it's the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. The special airs Saturday, the day after this goes live. Of course, that's going to be a thing. I mean, I haven't seen it yet. I'm reasonably certain it's going to make me happy. But the main thing is, you know, long before there was Night Vale, there was Newbridge. The best show on WFMU with Tom Sharpling is 3 hours of mirth, music, and mayhem. If you listen to it as a podcast, because of rights issues, it's basically 3 hours of mirth and mayhem. They leave out the music. but for me, this show, which has been around since 2001, is a comedic institution. And when a comedic institution is so consistently good and so consistently funny, you can sort of forget about it. And I found myself doing that. But there are 4 episodes left as of the Friday that the show airs. He's ending it on December 17th after 13 and fantastic years. If you want to try it, there's a podcast called Best Show Gems, which takes the dialogue between Tom Sharpling and John Worcester calling into the show as one of many different residents of the town, the fictional town of Newbridge. Those moments, this show is going to be remembered for a long time. Both Sharpling and Worcester are going to go on to do other things. But man, this
Worcester's
is so
already
good.
Playing in all the bands.
Absolutely. Yeah. He's in Superchunk and what else?
Superchunk, Mountain Goats. And by the way, my favorite Sharpling and Worcester bit ever which you can Google and find, is where John Worster calls in as a member of the incredibly generic alt-rock band Mother 13.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
So fantastic.
Yeah, so seek it out. It airs 9 to midnight on Tuesdays on WFMU. You can listen to it streaming. It's also available as a podcast. Or, as I say, if you want to start off, try a couple best show gems. They're much shorter. It might be up your speed.
Up your speed. It might float your fancy.
It might float your fancy.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Well, I am a person who some weeks has big happy things, and other weeks are kind of lower energy, chill kind of weeks. And this was one of those lower energy, chill kind of weeks. So I just have a few little things that were sort of chipping away at my melancholy, I would say.
Oh, good.
You know, one is that a year and a half ago at Silver Docks, I saw a documentary called Time Zero, The Last Year of Polaroid Film, that I talked about a bunch, that I put on a couple of lists of movies that I had really enjoyed. And it did not get any kind of distribution, and it didn't go anywhere, and nobody got a chance to see it for a super long time unless they went to film festivals. It's about when Polaroid announced that they were going to stop making Polaroid film. But as it turned out, there were a bunch of people who really had made an art out of Polaroids and felt very, very strongly about the ability to make an instant photo that was printed instantly, not a digital photo, but a real thing printed on that silvery film. And Polaroid, when they stopped making it, it immediately became this thing where people were hoarding these precious boxes of film, and people went and raided the few places left that had it and bought it all up. And this documentary, again, called Time Zero, The Last Year of Polaroid Film, is finally going to be on iTunes. And I just could not be more thrilled, because it really is a special movie that I loved very much that did not get out there the way that a lot of the docs that I love do. John Waters is in it, talking about his habit of taking a Polaroid of absolutely everyone who comes to his house, whether, as he sort of explains it, like whether it's a plumber or a one-night stand or whoever, he takes a Polaroid of everyone who comes into his house, and he has them in these glorious giant file boxes. It's really, really great and charming. Other than that, I would name just a few things. The most recent episode, as we tape this, of the Judge John Hodgman podcast featured a 14-year-old girl. Her name was Sophie, and her father's name is Chris, and he wanted her to go out and be more of an extrovert. And it's just this incredibly generous, wise, you know, if you are a parent who has a shy kid or an introverted kid or a kid who you struggle with the desire to push them out there and they don't want to be pushed, and it's just so kind and sweet and lovely. Again, Judge John Hodgman, most recent episode as of right now. And finally, there's a newish Aziz Ansari special, which is on Netflix, which I also thought was terrific. You know, he's kind of coming into a certain mastery of his material, I think, that I really like. And it's called Buried Alive, and it's exclusive to Netflix right now. So you can find it streaming there. Great. And those are kind of my little things making me happy this week.
Excellent.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, Stephen. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Lauren Migaki, at L. Migaki, that's M-I-G-A-K-I. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. We want you to know there are lots of other NPR podcasts, including Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington. Snap is storytelling with a beat, an intimate and musical kind of storytelling, stories that connect, captivate, and invite you to listen closely. That's Snap Judgment. Find it on iTunes under Podcasts.